She did not want children. She wanted me, just me. And she got me. She did not want men in her life. She wanted a man, the right man. And shortly before she died, she found him. I have said that my Aunt Martha is a lovely woman, and I mean it. She is warm, she is attractive, she is decent and kind and honorably intentioned. And she has always been loving to me. She loved my mother, too. She just never understood her. And when however small a measure of jealousy is mixed with misunderstanding, there is going to be trouble. I have said that my mother was a sweater girl, and that is a contradiction to the general modesty with which she dressed. She did show off her bosom, but never her flesh, except for her athletic, almost innocent shoulders. She did like to bare her shoulders, and her dress was never slatternly, never wanton, never garish. She was so conservative in her choice of colors that I remember little in her wardrobe that wasn't black or white, except for some accessories. She had a fondness for red, in scarves and hats and shoes and mittens and gloves. She wore nothing that was tight around her hips, but she did like her small waist and her good bosom to show. She did have
the best breasts of all the mothers,
as Owen observed. I do not think that she flirted. She did not come on to men. But how much of that would I have seen up to the age of 11? So maybe she did flirt, a little. I used to imagine that her flirting was reserved for the Boston and Maine, that she was absolutely and properly my mother in every location upon this earth, even in Boston, the dreaded city, but that on the train she might have looked for men. What else could explain her having met the man who fathered me there? And some 6 years later, on the same train, she met the man who would marry her. Did the rhythm of the train on the tracks somehow unravel her and make her behave out of character? Was she altered in transit when her feet were not upon the ground? I expressed this absurd fear only once, and only to Owen. He was shocked.
"How could you think such a thing about your own mother?"
he asked me.
"But you say she's sexy. You're the one who raves about her breasts,"
I told him.
"I don't rave,"
Owen told me.
"Well, okay, I mean, you like her,"
I said.
"Men and boys, they like her." "Forget that about the train,"
Owen said.
"Your mother is a perfect woman. Nothing happens to her on the train."
Well, although she said she met my father on the Boston and Maine, I never imagined that my conception occurred there. It is a fact, however, that she met the man she would marry on that train. That story was neither a lie nor a secret. How many times I asked her to tell me that story, and she never hesitated. She never lacked enthusiasm for telling that story, which she told the same way every time. And after she was dead, how many times I asked him to tell me the story, and he would tell it with enthusiasm and the same way, every time. His name was Dan Needham. How many times I have prayed to God that he was my real father. My mother and my grandmother and I, and Lydia, minus one of her legs, were eating dinner on a Thursday evening in the spring of 1948. Thursdays were the days my mother returned from Boston, and we always had a better-than-average dinner those nights. I remember that it was shortly after Lydia's leg had been amputated, because it was still a little strange to have her eating with us at the table, in her wheelchair, and to have the two new maids doing the serving and the clearing that only recently Lydia had done. And the wheelchair was still new enough to Lydia so that she wouldn't allow me to push her around in it. Only my grandmother and my mother, and one of the two new maids, were allowed to. I don't remember all the trivial intricacies of Lydia's wheelchair rules, just that the four of us were finishing our dinner, and Lydia's presence at the dinner table was as new and noticeable as fresh paint. And my mother said, "I've met another man on the good old Boston and Maine." It was not intended, I think, as an entirely mischievous remark. But the remark took instant and astonishing hold of Lydia and my grandmother and me. Lydia's wheelchair surged in reverse away from the table, dragging the tablecloth after her so that all the dishes and glasses and silverware jumped and the candlesticks wobbled. My grandmother seized the large brooch at the throat of her dress. She appeared to have suddenly choked on it, and I snapped so substantial a piece of my lower lip between my teeth that I could taste my blood. We had all thought that my mother was speaking euphemistically. I wasn't present when she'd announced the particulars of the case of the first man she claimed she'd met on the train. Maybe she'd said, "I met a man on the good old Boston and Maine, and now I'm pregnant." Maybe she said, "I'm going to have a baby as a result of a fling I had with a total stranger I met on the good old Boston and Maine, someone I never expect to see again." Well, anyway, if I can't recreate the first announcement, the second announcement was spectacular enough. We all thought that she was telling us that she was pregnant again, by a different man. And as an example of how wrong my Aunt Martha was, concerning her point of view that my mother was a little simple, my mother instantly saw what we were thinking and laughed at us very quickly and said, "No, no, I'm not going to have a baby. I'm never going to have another baby. I have my baby. I'm just telling you that I've met a man, someone I like." "A different man, Tabitha?" my grandmother asked, still holding her brooch. "Oh, not that man. Don't be silly," my mother said, and she laughed again, her laughter drawing Lydia's wheelchair ever so cautiously back toward the table.
"A man you like, you mean, Tabitha?" my grandmother asked.
"I wouldn't mention him if I didn't like him," my mother said. "I want you to meet him," she said to us all.
"You've dated him?" my grandmother asked.
"No, I just met him. Just today, on today's train," my mother said.
"And already you like him?"
Lydia asked in a tone of voice so perfectly copied from my grandmother that I had to look to see which one of them was speaking.
"Well, yes," my mother said seriously. "You know such things. You don't need that much time."
"How many times have you known such things before?" my grandmother asked.
"This is the first time, really," my mother said. "That's why I know."
Lydia and my grandmother instinctively looked at me, perhaps to ascertain if I'd understood my mother correctly, that the time before, when she'd had her fling, which had led to me, was not a time when my mother had enjoyed any special feelings toward whoever my father was. But I had another idea. I was thinking that maybe this was my father, that maybe this was the first man she'd met on the train, and he'd heard about me, and he was curious about me and wanted to see me, and something very important had kept him away for the last 6 years. There had, after all, been a war back when I'd been born in 1942. But as another example of how wrong my Aunt Martha was, my mother seemed to see what I was imagining immediately, because she said, "Please understand, Johnny, that this man has no relationship whatsoever to the man who is your father. This is a man I saw for the first time today, and I like him. That's all. I just like him, and I think you'll like him, too."
"Okay," I said, but I couldn't look at her. I remember keeping my eyes on Lydia's hands, gripping her wheelchair, and on my grandmother's hands, toying with her brooch.
"What does he do, Tabitha?"
my grandmother asked. That was a wheelwright thing to ask. In my grandmother's opinion, what one did was related to where one's family came from. She always hoped it was from England, and in the 17th century. And the short list of things that my grandmother approved of doing was no less specific than 17th century England.
"Dramatics," my mother said. "He's a sort of actor, but not really."
"An unemployed actor?" my grandmother asked.
I think now that an employed actor would have been unsuitable enough.
"No, he's not looking for employment as an actor. He's strictly an amateur actor," my mother said.
And I thought of those people in the train stations who handled puppets. I meant street performers, although at 6 years old I hadn't the vocabulary to suggest this.
"He teaches acting and putting on plays," my mother said.
A director?
My grandmother asked, more hopefully.
Not exactly, my mother said, and she frowned. He was on his way to Gravesend for an interview.
I can't imagine there's much opportunity for theater here, my grandmother said.
He had an interview at the academy, my mother said. It's a teaching job, the history of drama, or something. And the boys have their own theatrical productions. You know, Martha and I used to go to them. It was so funny how they had to dress up as girls. That was the funniest part of those productions in my memory. I'd had no idea that directing such performances was anyone's job.
So, he's a teacher? My grandmother asked.
This was borderline acceptable to Harriet Wheelwright, although my grandmother was a shrewd enough businesswoman to know that the dollars and cents of teaching, even at as prestigious a prep school as Gravesend Academy, were not exactly in her league.
Yes, my mother said in an exhausted voice. He's a teacher. He's been teaching dramatics in a private school in Boston. Before that, he went to Harvard, class of 45.
Goodness gracious, my grandmother said. Why didn't you begin with Harvard?
It's not important to him, my mother said.
But Harvard 45 was important enough to my grandmother to calm her troubled hands. They left her brooch alone and returned to rest in her lap. After a polite pause, Lydia inched her wheelchair forward and picked up the little silver bell and shook it for the maids to come clear, the very bell that had summoned Lydia so often, only yesterday, it seemed. And the bell had the effect of releasing us all from the paralyzing tension we had just survived, but for only an instant. My grandmother had forgotten to ask, "What is the man's name?" For in her view, we Wheelwrights were not out of the woods without knowing the name of the potential new member of the family. God forbid he was a Cohen, or a Calamari, or a Meany. Up went my grandmother's hands to her brooch again.
His name is Daniel Needham, my mother said.
Phew! With what relief! Down came my grandmother's hands. Needham was a fine old name, a founding father's sort of name, a name you could trace back to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, if not exactly to Gravesend itself, and Daniel as Daniel Webster, which was as good a name as a wheelwright could wish for.
But he's called Dan,
my mother added, bringing a slight frown to my grandmother's countenance. She had never gone along with making Tabitha a tabby, and if she'd had a Daniel, she wouldn't have made him a Dan. But Harriet Wheelwright was fair-minded enough and smart enough to yield in the case of a small difference of opinion.
"So, have you made a date?" my grandmother asked.
"Not exactly," my mother said, "but I know I'll see him again."
"But you haven't made any plans?" my grandmother asked.
Vagueness annoyed her.
"If he doesn't get the job at the academy," my grandmother said, "you may never see him again."
"But I know I'll see him again," my mother repeated.
"You can be such a know-it-all, Tabitha Wheelwright," my grandmother said crossly. "I don't know why young people find it such a burden to plan ahead."
And to this notion, as to almost everything my grandmother said, Lydia wisely nodded her head. The explanation for her silence was that my grandmother was expressing exactly what Lydia would have expressed only seconds before Lydia could have done so. Then the doorbell rang. Both Lydia and my grandmother stared at me as if only my friends would be uncouth enough to make a call after dinner, uninvited.
"Heavens, who is that?"
grandmother asked, and she and Lydia both took a pointed and overly long look at their wristwatches. Although it was not even 8 o'clock on a balmy spring evening, there was still some light in the sky.
"I'll bet that's him,"
my mother said, getting up from the table to go to the door. She gave herself a quick and approving look in the mirror over the sideboard where the roast sat, growing cold, and she hurried into the hall.
"Then you did make a date?" my grandmother asked. "Did you invite him?"
"Not exactly," my mother called, "but I told him where I lived." Nothing is exactly with young people, I've noticed, my grandmother said, more to Lydia than to me. It certainly isn't, said Lydia. But I'd heard enough of them. I had heard them for years. I followed my mother to the door. My grandmother, pushing Lydia in her wheelchair in front of her, followed me. Curiosity, which, in New Hampshire in those days, was often said to be responsible for the death of cats, had got the better of us all. We knew that my mother had no immediate plans to reveal to us a single clue regarding the first man she'd supposedly met on the Boston and Maine, but the second man, we could see him for ourselves. Dan Needham was on the doorstep of 80 Front Street, Gravesend. Of course, my mother had had dates before, but she'd never said of one of them that she wanted us to meet him, or that she even liked him, or that she knew she'd see him again. And so we were aware that Dan Needham was special from the start. I suppose Aunt Martha would have said that one aspect of my mother being a little simple was her attraction to younger men. But in this habit, my mother was simply ahead of her time. Because it's true, the men she dated were often a little younger than she was. She even went out with a few seniors from Gravesend Academy when, if she'd gone to college, she would have been a college senior herself. But she just went out with them. While they were only prep school boys and she was in her 20s, with an illegitimate child, all she did with those boys was dance with them, or go to movies or plays with them, or to the sporting events. I was used to seeing a few goons come calling, I will admit, but they never knew how to respond to me. They had no idea, for example, what a 6-year-old was. They either brought me rubber ducks for the bath or other toys for virtual infants, or else they brought me Fowler's Modern English Usage, something every 6-year-old should plunge into. And when they saw me, when they were confronted with my short, sturdy presence and the fact that I was too old for bathtub toys and too young for modern English usage, they would become insanely restless to impress me with their sensitivity to a waist-high person like myself. They would suggest a game of catch in the backyard, and then rifle an uncatchable football into my small face, or they would palaver to me in baby talk about showing them my favorite toy, so that they might know what kind of thing was more appropriate to bring me next time. There was rarely a next time. Once one of them asked my mother if I was toilet trained. I guess he found this a suitable question prior to his inviting me to sit on his knees and play bucking bronco.
You should have said yes,
Owen Meany told me,
and then pissed in his lap.
One thing about my mother's beaux, they were all good-looking. So on that superficial level, I was unprepared for Dan Needham, who was tall and gawky, with curly, carrot-colored hair, and who wore eyeglasses that were too small for his egg-shaped face, the perfectly round lenses giving him the apprehensive, hunting expression of a large mutant owl. My grandmother said, after he'd gone, that it must have been the first time in the history of Gravesend Academy that they had hired someone who looks younger than the students. Furthermore, his clothes didn't fit him. The jacket was too tight, the sleeves too short, and the trousers were so baggy that the crotch flapped nearer his knees than his hips, which were womanly and the only padded parts of his peculiar body. But I was too young and cynical to spot his kindness. Even before he was introduced to my grandmother, or to Lydia, or to me, he looked straight at me and said, "You must be Johnny. I heard as much about you as anyone can hear in an hour and a half on the Boston and Maine, and I know you can be trusted with an important package." It was a brown shopping bag with another brown paper bag stuffed inside it. Oh boy, here it comes, I thought, an inflatable camel. It floats and spits. But Dan Needham said, "It's not for you. It's not for anyone your age. But I'm trusting you to put it somewhere where it can't be stepped on, and out of the way of any pets, if you have pets. You mustn't let a pet near it. And whatever you do, don't open it. Just tell me if it moves." Then he handed it to me.
It didn't weigh enough to be Fowler's modern English usage, and if I was to keep it away from pets and tell him if it moved, clearly it was alive. I put it quickly under the hall table, the telephone table we called it, and I stood halfway in the hall and halfway in the living room where I could watch Dan Needham taking a seat. Taking a seat in my grandmother's living room was never easy, because many of the available seats were not for sitting in. They were antiques, which my grandmother was preserving for historical reasons. Sitting in them was not good for them. Therefore, although the living room was quite sumptuously arranged with upholstered chairs and couches, very little of this furniture was usable. And so a guest, his or her knees already bending in the act of sitting down, would suddenly snap to attention as my grandmother shouted, "Oh, for goodness sake, not there! You can't sit there!" And the startled person would attempt to try the next chair or couch, which in my grandmother's opinion would also collapse or burst into flames at the strain. And I suppose my grandmother noticed that Dan Needham was tall and that he had a sizable bottom, and this no doubt meant to her that an even fewer than usual number of seats were available to him, while Lydia, not yet deft with her wheelchair, blocked the way here and the way there, and neither my mother nor my grandmother had yet developed that necessary reflex to simply wheel her out of the way. And so the living room was a scene of idiocy and confusion, with Dan Needham spiraling toward one vulnerable antique after another, and my mother and grandmother colliding with Lydia's wheelchair while grandmother barked this and that command regarding who should sit where. I hung back on the threshold of this awkwardness, keeping an eye on the ominous shopping bag, imagining that it had moved a little, or that a mystery pet would suddenly materialize beside it and either eat or be eaten by the contents of the bag. We had never had a pet. My grandmother thought that people who kept pets were engaged in the basest form of self-mockery, intentionally putting themselves on a level with animals. Nevertheless, it made me extremely jumpy to observe the bag, awaiting its slightest twitch, and it made me even jumpier to observe the foolish nervousness of the adult ritual taking place in the living room. Gradually, I gave my whole attention to the bag. I slipped away from the threshold of the living room and retreated into the hall, sitting cross-legged on the scatter rug in front of the telephone table. The sides of the bag were almost breathing, and I thought I could detect an odor foreign to human experience. It was the suspicion of this odor that drew me nearer to the bag, until I crawled under the telephone table and put my ear to the bag and listened, and peered over the top of the bag. But the bag inside the bag blocked my view. In the living room, they were talking about history. That was Dan Needham's actual appointment, in the history department. He had studied enough history at Harvard to be qualified to teach the conventional courses in that field at Gravesend. "Oh, you got the job," my mother said. What was special in his approach was his use of the history of drama, and here he said something about the public entertainment of any period distinguishing the period as clearly as its so-called politics. But I drifted in and out of the sense of his remarks, so intent was I on the contents of the shopping bag in the hall. I picked up the bag and held it in my lap and waited for it to move. In addition to his interview with the history department members and with the headmaster, Dan Needham was saying, he had requested some time to address those students interested in theater and any faculty members who were interested too. And in this session, he had attempted to demonstrate how the development of certain techniques of the theatrical arts, how certain dramatic skills, can enhance our understanding of not only the characters on a stage, but of a specific time and place as well. And for this session with the drama students, Dan Needham was saying, he always brought along a certain prop. Something interesting, either to hold or focus the students' attention, or to distract them from what he would finally make them see. He was rather long-winded, I thought. "What props?" my grandmother asked. "Yes, what props?" Lydia said. and Dan Needham said that a prop could be anything. Once he'd used a tennis ball, and once a live bird in a cage. That was it, I thought, feeling that whatever it was in the bag was hard and lifeless and unmoving, and a bird cage would be all that. The bird, of course, I couldn't touch. Still, I wanted to see it, and with trepidation, and as silently as possible so that the boars in the living room would not hear the paper crinkling of the two bags, I opened just a little bit of the bag within the bag. The face that stared intently into mine was not a bird's face, and no cage prevented this creature from leaping out at me, and the creature appeared not only poised to leap out at me, but eager to do so. Its expression was fierce. Its snout, as narrow as the nose of a fox, was pointed at my face like a gun. Its wild, bright eyes winked with hatred and fearlessness, and the claws of its forepaws, which were reaching toward me, were long and prehistoric. It looked like a weasel in a shell, like a ferret with scales. I screamed. I also forgot I was sitting under the telephone table because I leaped up, knocking over the table and tangling my feet in the phone cord. I couldn't get away. And when I lunged out of the hall and into the living room, the telephone and the phone table and the beast in the bag were all dragged, with considerable clamor, after me. And so I screamed again. "Goodness gracious!" my grandmother cried. But Dan Needham said cheerfully to my mother, "I told you he'd open the bag." At first I had thought Dan Needham was a fool, like all the others, and that he didn't know the first thing about six-year-olds, that to tell a six-year-old not to open a bag was an invitation to open it. But he knew very well what a six-year-old was like. To his credit, Dan Needham was always a little bit of a six-year-old himself. "What in heaven's name is in the bag?" my grandmother asked, as I finally freed myself from the phone cord and went crawling to my mother. "My prop," Dan Needham said. It was some prop, all right, for in the bag was a stuffed armadillo. To a boy from New Hampshire, an armadillo resembled a small dinosaur, for who in New Hampshire ever heard of a 2-foot-long rat with a shell on its back and claws as distinguished as an anteater's? Armadillos eat insects and earthworms and spiders and land snails, but I had no way of knowing that. It looked at least willing, if not able, to eat me. Dan Needham gave it to me. It was the first present any of my mother's beaux gave me that I kept. For years, long after its claws were gone, and its tail fell off, and its stuffing came out, and its sides collapsed, and its nose broken half, and its glass eyes were lost, I kept the bony plates from the shell of its back. I loved the armadillo, of course, and Owen Meany also loved it. We would be playing in the attic, abusing my grandmother's ancient sewing machine or dressing up in my dead grandfather's clothes, and Owen would say out of nowhere,
"Let's go get the armadillo. Let's bring it up here and hide it in the closet."
The closet that housed my dead grandfather's clothes was vast and mysterious, full of angles and overhead shelves and rows upon rows of shoes. We would hide the armadillo in the armpit of an old tuxedo. We would hide it in the leg of an old pair of waders or under a derby hat. We would hang it from a pair of suspenders. One of us would hide it, and the other one would have to find it in the dark closet with the aid of only a flashlight. No matter how many times we had seen the armadillo, to come upon it in the black closet to suddenly light up its insane, violent face was always frightening. Every time the finder found it, he would yell. Owen's yelling would occasionally produce my grandmother, who would not willingly mount the rickety staircase to the attic and struggle with the attic's trap door. She would stand at the foot of the staircase and say,
"Not so loud, you boys!"
And she would sometimes add that we were to be careful with the ancient sewing machine and with grandfather's clothes, because she might want to sell them someday.
"That sewing machine is an antique, you know!"
Well, Almost everything at 80 Front Street was an antique, and almost none of it, Owen and I knew perfectly well, would ever be sold. Not at least while my grandmother was alive. She liked her antiques, as was evidenced by the growing number of chairs and couches in the living room that no one was allowed to sit on. As for the discards in the attic, Owen and I knew they were safe forever. And searching among those relics for the terrifying armadillo, which itself looked like some relic of the animal world, some throwback to an age when men were taking a risk every time they left the cave, hunting for that stuffed beast among the artifacts of my grandmother's culture was one of Owen Meany's favorite games.
"I can't find it,"
he would call out from the closet.
"I hope you didn't put it in the shoes, because I don't want to step on it before I see it. And I hope you didn't put it on the top shelf, because I don't like to have it above me. I hate to see it looking down at me, and it's no fair putting it where it will fall down if I just touch something, because that's too scary. And when it's inside the sleeves, I can't find it without reaching inside for it. That's no fair either." "Just shut up and find it, Owen," I would say. "No fair putting it in the hat boxes," Owen would say, while I listened to him stumbling over the shoes inside the closet. "And no fair when it springs out at me because you stretch the suspenders in that way. Ah! That's no fair!"
Before Dan Needham brought anything as exotic as that armadillo or himself into my life, my expectations regarding anything unusual were reserved for Owen Meany, and for school holidays and portions of my summer vacation when my mother and I would travel up north to visit Aunt Martha and her family. To anyone in coastal New Hampshire, up north could mean almost anywhere else in the state, but Aunt Martha and Uncle Alfred lived in the White Mountains, in what everyone called the North Country, and when they or my cousins said they were going up north, they meant a relatively short drive to any of several towns that were a little north of them, to Bartlett or to Jackson, up where the real skiing was. And in the summers, Loveless Lake, where we went to swim, was also up north from where the Eastmans lived, in Sawyer Depot. It was the last train station on the Boston and Maine before North Conway, where most of the skiers got off. Every Christmas vacation and Easter, my mother and I and our skis departed the train in Sawyer Depot. From the depot itself, we would walk to the Eastman's house. In the summer, when we visited at least once, it was an even easier walk without our skis. Those train rides, at least 2 hours from Gravesend, were the most concrete occasions I was given in which to imagine my mother riding the Boston and Maine in the other direction, south to Boston, where I almost never went. But the passengers traveling north, I always believed, were very different types from the city-bound travelers, skiers, hikers, mountain lake swimmers. These were not men and women seeking trysts or keeping assignations. The ritual of those train rides north is unforgettable to me, although I remember nothing of the equal number of rides back to Gravesend. Return trips to this day, from anywhere, are simply invitations to dull trances or leaden slumber. But every time we rode the train to Sawyer Depot, my mother and I weighed the advantages of sitting on the left-hand side of the train so that we could see Mount Chocorua, or on the right-hand side, so that we could see Ossipee Lake. Chocorua was our first indication of how much snow there would be where we were going, but there's more visible activity around a lake than there is on a mountain, and so we would sometimes opt for Ossipee, as Mother and I described our decision. We also played a game that involved guessing where everyone was going to get off, and I always ate too many of those little tea sandwiches that they served on board, the kind with the crusts cut off. This overeating served to justify my inevitable trip to that lurching pit with the railroad ties going by underneath me in a blur and the whoosh of rank air that blew upward on my bare bottom. My mother would always say, "We're almost at Sawyer Depot, Johnny. Wouldn't you be more comfortable if you waited until we got to your Aunt Martha's?" Yes, and no. I could almost always have waited, yet it was not only necessary to empty my bladder and bowels before encountering my cousins. It was a needed test of courage to sit naked over that dangerous hole, imagining lumps of coal and loosened railroad spikes hurtling up at me at bruising speed. I needed the empty bladder and bowels because there was immediate rough treatment ahead. My cousins always greeted me with instant acrobatics, if not actual violence, and I needed to brace myself for them, to frighten myself a little in order to be ready for all the future terrors that the vacation held in store for me. I would never describe my cousins as bullies. They were good-natured, rambunctious roughnecks and daredevils who genuinely wanted me to have fun. But fun in the North Country was not what I was used to in my life with the women at 80 Front Street, Gravesend. I did not wrestle with my grandmother, or box with Lydia, not even when she had both her legs. I did play croquet with my mother, but croquet is not a contact sport, and given that my best friend was Owen Meany, I was not inclined to much in the way of athletic roughhousing. My mother loved her sister and brother-in-law. They always made her feel special and welcome. They certainly made me feel that way, and my mother doubtless appreciated a little time away from my grandmother's imperious wisdom. Grandmother would come to Sawyer Depot for a few days at Christmas, and she would make a grand appearance for one weekend every summer, but the North Country was not to grandmother's liking, and although grandmother was perfectly tolerant of my solitary disruption of the adult life at 80 Front Street, and even moderately tolerant of the games I would play in that old house with Owen, she had scant patience for the disruption caused in any house by all her grandchildren. For Thanksgiving, the Eastmans came to 80 Front Street, a disturbance that my grandmother referred to in terms of the casualties for several months after their visit. My cousins were active, combative athletes. My grandmother called them the Warriors, and I lived a different life whenever I was with them. I was both crazy about them and terrified of them. I couldn't contain my excitement as the time to see them drew near, but after several days I couldn't wait to get away from them. I missed the peace of my private games, and I missed Owen Meany. I even missed grandmother's constant but consistent criticism. My cousins, Noah, Simon, and Hester, in order of their ages, were all older than I. Hester was older by less than a year, although she would always be bigger. Simon was older by 2 years, Noah by 3. Those are not great differences in age, to be sure, but they were great enough in all those years before I was a teenager, when each of my cousins was better than I was, at everything. Since they grew up in the North Country, they were fabulous skiers. I was at best a cautious skier, modeling my slow, wide turns on my mother's graceful but undaring stem Christy. She was a pretty skier, of intermediate ability, who was consistently in control. She did not think that the essence of the sport was speed, nor did she fight the mountain. My cousins raced each other down the slopes, cutting each other off, knocking each other down, and rarely restraining their routes of descent to the marked trails. They would lead me into the deep, unmanageable powder snow in the woods, and in my efforts to keep up with them, I would abandon the controlled, conservative skiing that my mother had taught me and end up straddling trees, embracing snow fences, losing my goggles in icy streams. My cousins were sincere in their efforts to teach me to keep my skis parallel and to hop on my skis, but a school vacation skier is never the equal to a North Country native. They set such standards for recklessness that eventually I could no longer have fun skiing with my mother. I felt guilty that I made her ski alone, but my mother was rarely left alone for long. By the end of the day, some man, a would-be ski instructor, if not an actual ski instructor, would be coaching her at her side. What I remember of skiing with my cousins is long, humiliating, and hurtling falls, followed by my cousins retrieving my ski poles, my mittens, and my hat, from which I became inevitably separated.
Are you all right? My eldest cousin Noah would ask me. That looked rather harsh. That looked neat, my cousin Simon would say. Simon loved to fall. He skied to crash.
You keep doing that, you'll make yourself sterile, said my cousin Hester,
to whom every event of our shared childhood was either sexually exhilarating or sexually damaging. In the summers, we went water skiing on Loveless Lake, where the Eastmans kept a boathouse, the second floor of which was remodeled to resemble an English pub. Uncle Alfred was admiring of the English. My mother and Aunt Martha would go sailing, but Uncle Alfred drove the powerboat wildly and fast, a beer in his free hand. Because he did not water ski himself, Uncle Alfred thought that the responsibility of the boat's driver was to make the skier's ride as harrowing as possible. He would double back in the middle of a turn so that the rope would go slack, or you could even catch up to the rope and ski over it. He drove a murderous figure eight. He appeared to relish surprising you by putting you directly in the path of an oncoming boat or of another surprised water skier on the busy lake. Regardless of the cause of your fall, Uncle Alfred took credit for it. When anyone racing behind the boat would send up a fabulous spray, skimming lengthwise across the water, skis ripped off, head under 1 second, up the next, and then under again, Uncle Alfred would shout, "Bingo!" I am living proof that the waters of Loveless Lake are potable, because I swallowed half the lake every summer while water skiing with my cousins. Once I struck the surface of the lake with such force that my right eyelid was rolled up into my head in a funny way. My cousin Simon told me I had lost my eyelid, and my cousin Hester added that the lost eyelid would lead to blindness. But Uncle Alfred managed to locate the missing eyelid after a few anxious minutes. Indoor life with my cousins was no less vigorous. The savagery of pillow fighting would leave me breathless, and there was a game that involved Noah and Simon tying me up and stuffing me in Hester's laundry hamper, where Hester would always discover me. Before she'd untie me, she'd accuse me of sniffing her underwear. I know that Hester especially looked forward to my visits, because she suffered from being the constant inferior to her brothers, not that they abused her or even teased her. Considering that they were boys and older, and she was a girl and younger, I thought they treated her splendidly. But every activity my cousins engaged in was competitive, and it clearly irked Hester to lose. Naturally, her brothers could best her at everything. How she must have enjoyed having me around, for she could best me at anything. Even when we went to the Eastman Lumberyard and Sawmill, at log rolling. There was also a game that involved taking possession of a sawdust pile. Those piles were often 20 or 30 feet high, and the sawdust near the bottom, in contact with the ground, was often frozen, or at least hardened, to a crusty consistency. The object was to be king of the mountain, to hurl all comers off the top of the pile, or to bury one's attackers in the sawdust. The worst part about being buried in the pile, up to your chin, was that the lumberyard dog, the Eastman slobbering boxer, a mindlessly friendly beast with halitosis vile enough to give you visions of corpses uprooted from their graves, this dog, with the mouth of death, was then summoned to lick your face. And with the sawdust packed all around you, as armless as Wadahantowit's totem, you were powerless to fend the dog off. But I loved being with my cousins. They were so vastly stimulating that I could rarely sleep in their house and would lie awake all night waiting for them to pounce on me or for them to let Firewater, the boxer, into my room where he would lick me to death. Or I would just lie awake imagining what exhausting contests I would encounter the next day. For my mother, our trips to Sawyer Depot were serene occasions. Fresh air and girl talk with Aunt Martha, and some doubtless needed relief from what must have been the claustrophobia of her life with Grandmother and Lydia and the maids at 80 Front Street. Mother must have been dying to leave home. Almost everyone is dying to leave home eventually, and almost everyone needs to. But for me,
Sawyer Depot was a training camp. Yet the athleticism was not, all by itself, what was most thrilling to me about the time spent with my cousins. What made these contests thrilling was the pre-sexual tension that I always associated with the competition, that I always associated with Hester in particular. To this day, I still engage in debate with Noah and Simon regarding whether Hester was created by her environment, which was almost entirely created by Noah and Simon, which is my opinion, or whether she was born with an overdose of sexual aggression and family animosity, which is what Noah and Simon say. We all agree that my Aunt Martha, as a model of womanhood, was no match for the superior impression my Uncle Alfred made as a man. Felling trees, clearing the land, milling lumber. What a male business was the Eastman Lumber Company. The house in Sawyer Depot was spacious and pretty, for my Aunt Martha had acquired my grandmother's good taste, and she'd brought money of her own to the marriage. But Uncle Alfred made more money than we wheelwrights were simply sitting on. Uncle Alfred was a paragon of maleness, too, in that he was rich and he dressed like a lumberjack. That he spent most of the day behind a desk did not influence his appearance. Even if he only briefly visited the sawmill, and not more than twice a week did he actually venture into the forests where they were logging, he looked the part. Although he was fiercely strong, I never saw him do an ounce of physical labor. He radiated a burly good health, and despite how little time he spent in the field, there was always sawdust in his bushy hair, wood chips wedged between the laces of his boots, and a few fragrant pine needles ground into the knees of his blue jeans. Possibly, he kept the pine needles, the wood chips, and the sawdust in his office desk drawer. What does it matter? While wrestling with my cousins and me, Uncle Alfred was an ever-friendly bruiser, and the cologne of his rough-and-ready business, the veritable scent of the woods, was always upon him. I don't know how my Aunt Martha tolerated it, but Firewater often slept in the king-size bed in my uncle and aunt's room, and that was an even further manifestation of Uncle Alfred's manliness. That when he wasn't snuggling up to my lovely Aunt Martha, he was lolling in bed with a big dog. I thought Uncle Alfred was terrific, a wonderful father, and for boys, he was what today's idiots would call a superior role model. He must have been a difficult role model for Hester, however, because I think her worshipful love of him, in addition to her constant losses in the daily competitions with her older brothers, simply overwhelmed her and gave her an unwarranted contempt of my Aunt Martha. But I know what Noah would say to that. He would say, bullshit, that his mother was a model of sweetness and caring, and she was, I don't argue with that, and that Hester was born to her antagonism toward her mother, that she was born to challenge her parents' love with hostility toward both of them, and that the only way she could repay her brothers for out-skiing her on water and on snow, and for hurling her off sawdust piles, and for cramming her cousin into a basket with her old underwear, was to intimidate every girlfriend either of them ever had and to fuck the brains out of every boy they ever knew, which she appeared to do. It's a no-win argument, that business of what we're born with and what our environment does to us. And it's a boring argument, because it simplifies the mysteries that attend both our birth and our growth. Privately, I continue to be more forgiving of Hester than her own family is. I think she was up against a stacked deck from the start, and that everything she would become began for her when Noah and Simon made me kiss her, because they made it clear that kissing Hester was punishment, the penalty part of the game. To have to kiss Hester meant you had lost. I don't remember exactly how old we were when we were first forced to kiss, Hester and I, but it was sometime after my mother had met Dan Needham, because Dan was spending Christmas vacation with us at the Eastmans in Sawyer Depot, and it was sometime before my mother and Dan Needham were married, because Mother and I were still living at 80 Front Street. Whenever it was, Hester and I were still in our pre-adolescent years, our pre-sexual years, if that's safe to say. Perhaps that is never safe to say in regard to Hester, but I promise it is safe to say of me. Anyway, there'd been a thaw in the North Country, and some rain, and then an ice storm, which froze the slush in deep-grooved ruts. The snow was the texture of jagged glass, which made skiing all the more exciting for Noah and Simon, but made it entirely out of the question for me. So Noah and Simon went up north to brave the elements, and I stayed in the Eastmans' extremely comfortable house. I don't remember why Hester stayed home, too. Perhaps she was in a cranky temper, or else she just wanted to sleep in. For whatever reason, we were there together. And by the end of the day, when Noah and Simon returned, Hester and I were in her room playing Monopoly. I hate Monopoly, but even a capitalist board game was welcome relief from the more strenuous activities my cousins subjected me to, and Hester was either in a rare mood to be calm, or else I rarely saw her without the company of Noah and Simon, around whom it was impossible to remain calm. We were lounging on the thick, soft rug in Hester's room, with some of her old stuffed animals for pillows, when the boys, their hands and faces bitter cold from skiing, attacked us. They trod across the Monopoly game so effectively that there was no hope of recreating where our houses and hotels and tokens might have been.
"Whoa!" Noah yelled. "Look at this hanky-panky going on here!" "There's no hanky-panky going on," Hester said angrily.
"Whoa!"
Simon yelled.
"Watch out for Hester the molester!"
"Get out of my room," Hester shouted.
"Last one through the house has to kiss Hester the molester,"
Noah said. And he and Simon were off running. In a panic, I looked at Hester and took off after them. Through the house was a racing game that meant we had to travel through the back bedrooms, Noah and Simon's room and the back guest room, which was mine, down the back stairs, around the landing by the maid's room, where May, the maid, was likely to shout at us, and into the kitchen by May's usual entrance. She was also the cook. Then we chased each other through the kitchen and dining room, through the living room and the sunroom, and through Uncle Alfred's study, provided he wasn't in his study, and up the front stairs, past the front guest rooms, which were off the main hall, and through my aunt and uncle's bedroom, provided they weren't in their bedroom, and then into the back hall, the first room off of which was Hester's bathroom. The next room that we came to was the finish line, Hester's room itself. Of course, May emerged from her room to shout at Noah and Simon for running on the stairs, but only I was there on the landing to be shouted at, and only I had to slow down and say, "Excuse me," to May. And they closed the swinging door from the kitchen to the dining room after they ran through the doorway so that only I had to pause long enough to open it. Uncle Alfred was not in his study, but Dan Needham was reading in there, and only I paused long enough to say hello to Dan. At the top of the front stairs, Firewater blocked my way. He'd doubtless been asleep when Noah and Simon had raced by him, but now he was alert enough to play. He managed to get the heel of my sock in his mouth as I attempted to run around him, and I could not travel far down the main hall dragging him after me before I had to stop to give him my sock. So, I was the last one through the house. I was always the last one through the house. And therefore I was expected to pay the loser's price, which was to kiss Hester. In order to bring this forced intercourse about, it had been necessary for Noah and Simon to prevent Hester from locking herself in her bathroom, which she attempted, and then it was necessary for them to tie her to her bed, which they managed to do after a violent struggle that included the decapitation of one of Hester's more fragile stuffed animals, which she had futilely ruined by beating her brothers with it. At last, she was strapped prone to her bed, where she threatened to bite the lips off anyone who dared to kiss her, the thought of which filled me with such dread that Noah and Simon needed to use more mountain climbing rope to tie me on top of Hester.
We were bound, uncomfortably, face to face, and chest to chest, hips to hips, to make our humiliation more complete, and we were told that we would not be untied until we did it.
"Kiss her,"
Noah cried to me.
"Let him kiss you, Hester,"
Simon said. It occurs to me now that this suggestion was even less compelling to Hester than it was to me, and I could only think that Hester's snarling mouth was about as inviting as firewaters. Yet I think we both realized that the potential embarrassment of being mated to this conjugal position for any duration of time, while Noah and Simon observed our breathing and minor movements, would perhaps lead to even greater suffering than indulging in a single kiss. What fools we were to think that Noah and Simon were dull enough fellows to be satisfied with one kiss. We tried a tiny one, but Noah said,
"That wasn't on the lips."
We tried a small, close-lipped one on the lips, so brief that it was unnecessary to breathe. But this failed to satisfy Simon, who said,
"Open your mouths."
We opened our mouths. There was the problem of arranging the noses before we could enjoy the nervous exchange of saliva, the slithering contact of tongues, the surprising click of teeth. We were joined so long we had to breathe, and I was astonished at how sweet my cousin's breath was. To this day, I hope mine wasn't too bad. As abruptly as they had conceived of this game, my cousins announced that the game was over. They never marshaled as much enthusiasm for the many repeats of the game called Last One Through the House Has to Kiss Hester. Maybe they realized later that I began to intentionally lose the game. And what did they make of the time they untied us and Hester said to me,
"I felt your hard on."
"You did not,"
I said.
"I did. It wasn't much of a hard on," she said. "It was no big deal, but I felt it."
"You didn't,"
I said.
"I did," she said.
And it's true. It was no big deal, to be sure. It wasn't much of a hard-on, maybe. But I had one. Did Noah and Simon ever consider the danger of the game? The way they skied, on water and on snow, and later, the way they drove their cars, suggested to me that they thought nothing was dangerous. But Hester and I were dangerous. And they started it. Noah and Simon started it. Owen Meany rescued me. As you shall see, Owen was always rescuing me, but he began the lifelong process of rescuing me by rescuing me from Hester. Owen was extremely irritable regarding the time I spent with my cousins. He would be grouchy for several days before I left for Sawyer Depot, and he would be peevish and aloof for several days after I got back. Although I made a point of describing how physically damaging and psychologically upsetting the time spent with my cousins was, Owen was crabby. I thought he was jealous.
"You know, I was thinking," he said to me. "You know how when you ask me to spend the night, I almost always do it, and we have a good time, don't we?"
"Sure we do, Owen," I said.
"Well, if you asked me to come with you and your mother to Sawyer Depot, I probably would come, you know?"
he said.
"Or do you think your cousins wouldn't like me?"
"Of course they'd like you," I said, "but I don't know if you'd like them." I didn't know how to tell him that I thought he'd have a terrible time with my cousins, that if we picked him up and passed him over our heads in Sunday school, it was frightening to imagine what games my cousins might devise to play with Owen Meany.
"You don't know how to ski,"
I told him, "or water ski," I added. "And I don't think you'd like the log rolling or the sawdust piles." I could have added, "or kissing Hester," but I couldn't imagine Owen doing that. My God, I thought, my cousins would kill him.
"Well, maybe your mother could teach me how to ski, and you don't have to do the log rolling if you don't want to, do you?"
he asked. "Well, my cousins kind of make everything happen so fast," I said. "You don't always have time to say yes or no to something."
Well, maybe if you asked them not to be so rough with me until I got used to it, he said. They'd listen to you, wouldn't they?
I could not imagine it, Owen, together with my cousins. It seemed to me that they would be driven insane by the sight of him, and when he spoke, when they first encountered that voice, I could visualize their reaction only in terms of their inventing ways for Owen to be a projectile. They would make him the birdie for a badminton game. They would bind him to a single ski, launch him off the mountain top, and race him to the bottom. They would make him sit in a salad bowl and tow him at high speeds across Loveless Lake. They would bury him in sawdust and lose him. They'd never find him. Firewater would eat him.
They're sort of hard to control, my cousins, I said. That's the problem. You make them sound like wild animals, Owen said.
They are, kind of, I said.
But you have fun with them, Owen said. Wouldn't I have fun, too?
I have fun and I don't have fun, I told him. I just think my cousins might be too much for you.
You think I might be too much of a wimp for them, he said.
I don't think you're a wimp, Owen, I said.
But you think your cousins would think so,
he said. I don't know, I said.
Maybe I could meet them at your house when they come for Thanksgiving, he suggested. It's funny how you don't invite me over when they're staying here.
My grandmother thinks there are too many kids in the house already when they're here, I explained. But Owen sulked about it so moodily that I invited him to spend the night, which he always enjoyed. He went through this ritual of calling his father to ask if it was all right, but it was always all right with Mr. Meany. Owen stayed at 80 Front Street so frequently that he kept a toothbrush in my bathroom and a pair of pajamas in my closet. And after Dan Needham gave me the armadillo, Owen grew almost as attached to the little animal and to Dan as I was. When Owen would sleep in the other twin bed in my room, with the night table between us, we would carefully arrange the armadillo under the bedside lamp. In exact profile to both of us, the creature stared at the feet of our beds. The nightlight, which was attached to one of the legs of the night table, shone upward, illuminating the armadillo's chin and the exposed nostrils of its thin snout. Owen and I would talk until we were drowsy, but in the morning, I always noticed that the armadillo had been moved. Its face was turned more toward Owen than to me. Its profile was no longer perfect. And once, when I woke up, I saw that Owen was already awake. He was staring back at the armadillo, and he was smiling. After Dan Needham's armadillo came into my life, and the first occasion for me to travel to Sawyer Depot arose, I was not surprised that Owen took this opportunity to express his concern for the armadillo's well-being.
"From what you tell me about your cousins," Owen said, "I don't think you should take the armadillo to Sawyer Depot."
It had never occurred to me to take the armadillo with me, but Owen had clearly given some thought to the potential tragedy of such a journey.
"You might forget it on the train," he said, "or that dog of theirs might chew on it. What's the dog's name?"
"Firewater," I said.
"Yes, Firewater. He sounds dangerous to the armadillo to me," Owen said. "And if your cousins are these ruffians, like you say, there's no telling what kind of game they might think up. They might rip the armadillo to pieces or lose it in the snow."
"Yes, you're right," I said.
"If they wanted to take the armadillo water skiing, could you stop them?"
he asked. "Probably not," I said.
"That's just what I thought," he said. "You better not take the armadillo with you."
"Right," I said.
"You better let me take it home. I can look after it while you're away. If it's all alone here, one of the maids might do something stupid, or there could be a fire," he said.
"I never thought of that," I said.
"Well, it would be very safe with me," Owen said.
Of course, I agreed.
"And I've been thinking," he added. "Over next Thanksgiving, when your cousins are here, you better let me take the armadillo home with me then, too. It sounds to me like they'd be too violent with it. It has a very delicate nose, and the tail can break, too. And I don't think it's a good idea to show your cousins that game we play with the armadillo in the closet with your grandfather's clothes, he said. It sounds to me like they'd trample on the armadillo in the dark.
Or else they'd throw it out the window, I thought.
I agree, I said. Good, Owen said. Then it's all settled. I'll look after the armadillo when you're away, and when your cousins are here, I'll look after it too, over next Thanksgiving, when you're going to invite me over to meet your cousins. Okay? Okay, Owen, I said. Good, he said. He was very pleased about it, if a trifle nervous.
The first time he took the armadillo home with him, he brought a box stuffed with cotton. It was such an elaborately conceived and strongly built carrying case that the armadillo could have been mailed safely overseas in it. The box, Owen explained, had been used to ship some granite carving tools, some grave marking equipment, so it was very sturdy. Mr. Meany, in an effort to bolster the disappointing business at the quarry, was expanding his involvement in monument sales. Owen said his father resented selling some of his best pieces of granite to other granite companies that made gravestones and charged an arm and a leg for them, according to Mr. Meany. He had opened a gruesome monument shop downtown, Meany Monuments, the store was called, and the sample gravestones in the storefront window looked not so much like samples as like actual graves that someone had built a store around.
"It's absolutely frightful," my grandmother said. "It's a cemetery in a store," she remarked indignantly.
But Mr. Meany was new to monument sales. It was possible he needed just a little more time to make the store look right. Anyway, the armadillo was packed in a box designed for transporting chisels, for something Owen called
wedges and feathers.
And Owen solemnly promised that no harm would come to the diminutive beast. Apparently Mrs. Meany was frightened by it. Owen gave his parents no forewarning that the armadillo was visiting, but Owen maintained that this small shock served his mother right for going into his room uninvited. Owen's room, what little I ever saw of it, was as orderly and as untouchable as a museum. I think that is why it was so easy for me to imagine for years that the baseball that killed my mother was surely a resident souvenir in Owen's odd room. I will never forget the Thanksgiving vacation when I introduced Owen Meany to my reckless cousins. The day before my cousins were to arrive in Gravesend, Owen came over to 80 Front Street to pick up the armadillo.
"They're not getting here until late tomorrow," I told him.
"What if they come early?"
he asked.
"Something could happen. It's better not to take a chance."
Owen wanted to come over to meet my cousins immediately following Thanksgiving dinner, but I thought the day after Thanksgiving would be better. I suggested that everyone always felt so stuffed after Thanksgiving dinner that it was never a very lively time.
"But I was thinking that they might be calmer right after they had eaten," Owen said.
I admit, I enjoyed his nervousness. I was worried that my cousins might be in some rare, mellow condition when Owen met them, and therefore he'd think I'd just been making up stories about how wild they were, and that there was, therefore, no excuse for my never inviting him to Sawyer Depot. I wanted my cousins to like Owen, because I liked him. He was my best friend. But at the same time, I didn't want everything to be so enjoyable that I'd have to invite Owen to Sawyer Depot the next time I went. I was sure that would be disastrous. And I was nervous that my cousins would make fun of Owen. And I confess, I was nervous that Owen would embarrass me. I am ashamed of feeling that, to this day. Anyway, both Owen and I were nervous. We talked on the phone in whispers Thanksgiving night.
"Are they especially wild?"
he asked me.
"Not especially," I said.
"What time do they get up? What time tomorrow should I come over?"
he asked. The boys get up early, I said. But Hester sleeps a little later, or at least she stays in her room longer.
Noah is the oldest,
Owen said, although he had checked these statistics with me 100 times.
Yes,
I said.
And Simon is the next oldest, although he's just as big as Noah and even a little wilder,
Owen said. Yes, yes, I said.
And Hester's the youngest, but she's bigger than you,
he said.
And she's pretty, but not that pretty, right?
Right, I said. Hester just missed the Eastman good looks. It was an especially masculine good looks that Noah and Simon got from my Uncle Alfred. Broad shoulders, big bones, a heavy jaw. And from my Aunt Martha, the boys got their blondness and their aristocracy. But the broad shoulders, the big bones, and the heavy jaw, these were less attractive on Hester, who did not receive either my aunt's blondness or her aristocracy. Hester was as dark and hairy as Uncle Alfred, even including his bushy eyebrows, which were actually one solid eyebrow without a gap above the bridge of the nose, and she had Uncle Alfred's big hands. Hester's hands looked like paws. Yet Hester had sex appeal, in the manner, in those days, that tough girls were also sexy girls. She had a large, athletic body, and as a teenager, she would have to struggle with her weight. But she had clear skin, she had solid curves, her mouth was aggressive, flashing lots of healthy teeth, and her eyes were taunting, with a dangerous-looking intelligence. Her hair was wild and thick.
I have this friend,
I told Hester that evening. I thought I would begin with her and try to win her over, and then tell Noah and Simon about Owen. But even though I was speaking quietly to Hester, and I thought that Noah and Simon were engaged in finding a lost station on the radio, the boys heard me and were instantly curious.
What friend?
Noah said.
Well, he's my best friend, I said cautiously.
And he wants to meet all of you.
Fine, great. So where is he? And what's his name?
Simon said.
Owen Meany,
I said as straightforwardly as possible.
Who?
Noah said. The three of them laughed.
What a wimp name,
Simon said.
What's wrong with him?
Hester asked me.
Nothing's wrong with him, I said a little too defensively. He's rather small.
Rather small?
Noah repeated, sounding very British.
Rather a wimp, is he?
Said Simon, imitating his brother.
No, he's not a wimp, I said. He's just small. And he has a funny voice,
I blurted out.
A funny voice?
Noah said in a funny voice.
A funny voice?
Said Simon in a different funny voice.
So he's a little guy with a funny voice, Hester said. So what?
So what's wrong with him?
Nothing,
I repeated.
Why should anything be wrong with him, Hester?
Noah asked her.
Hester probably wants to molest him,
Simon said.
Shut up, Simon, Hester said.
Both of you shut up,
Noah said.
I want to know why Hester thinks there's something wrong with everybody.
There's something wrong with all of your friends, Noah, Hester said.
And every friend of Simon's, she added. I'll just bet there's something wrong with Johnny's friends, too.
I suppose there's nothing wrong with your friends,
Noah said to his sister.
Hester doesn't have any friends,
Simon said.
Shut up,
Hester said.
I wonder why,
Noah said.
Shut up,
Hester said.
Well, there's nothing wrong with Owen,
I said, except he's small and his voice is a little different.
He sounds like fun,
Noah said pleasantly.
Hey,
Simon said, patting me on the back.
If he's your friend, don't worry. We'll be nice to him.
Hey,
Noah said, patting me on the back, too.
Don't worry. We'll all have fun.
Hester shrugged.
We'll see,
she said. I had not kissed her since Easter. In my summer visit to Sawyer Depot, we had been outdoors every waking minute, and there'd been no suggestion to play Last One Through the House Has to Kiss Hester. I doubted we'd get to play that game over Thanksgiving either, because my grandmother did not allow racing all over the house at 80 Front Street. So maybe I'll have to wait until Christmas, I thought.
Maybe a friend would like to kiss Hester, Simon said.
I decide who kisses me, Hester said.
Whoa, Noah said.
I think Owen will be a little timid around all of you, I ventured.
You're saying he wouldn't like to kiss me? Hester asked.
I'm just saying he might be a little shy around all of you, I said.
You like kissing me? Hester said.
I don't, I lied.
You do, she said.
Whoa, said Noah.
There's no stopping Hester the molester, Simon said.
Shut up, Hester said. And so the stage was set for Owen Meany. That day after Thanksgiving, my cousins and I were making so much noise up in the attic that we didn't hear Owen Meany creep up the attic stairs and open the trap door. I can imagine what Owen was thinking. He was probably waiting to be noticed so that he wouldn't have to announce himself, so that the very first thing my cousins would know about him wouldn't be that voice. On the other hand, the sight of how small and peculiar he was might have been an equal shock to my cousins. Owen must have been weighing these two ways of introducing himself, whether to speak up, which was always startling, or whether to wait until one of them saw him, which might be more than startling. Owen told me later that he just stood by the trap door, which he had closed loudly, on purpose, hoping that the door would get our attention, but we didn't notice the trap door. Simon had been pumping the foot pedals of the sewing machine so vigorously that the needle and bobbin were a blur of activity, and Noah had managed to shove Hester's arm too close to the plunging needle and thread so that the sleeve of Hester's blouse had been stitched to the piece of sample cloth she'd been sewing, and it was necessary for her to take her blouse off in order to free herself from the machine, which Simon, insanely, refused to stop pedaling. While Owen was watching us, Noah was whacking Simon about his ears to make him stop with the foot pedals, and Hester was standing in her T-shirt, tensed and flushed, wailing about her only white blouse, from which she was trying to extract a very random pattern of purple thread. And I was saying that if we didn't stop making such a racket, we could expect a ferocious lecture from Grandmother regarding the resale value of her antique sewing machine. All this time, Owen Meany was standing by the trap door, observing us, alternately getting up the nerve to introduce himself and deciding to bolt for home before any of us noticed that he was there. At that moment, my cousins must have seemed even worse than his worst dreams about them. It was shocking how Simon loved to be beaten. I never saw a boy whose best defense against the beating routinely administered by an older brother was to adore being beaten. Just as much as he loved to roll down mountains and to be flung off sawdust piles and to ski so wildly that he struck glancing blows to trees, Simon thrived under the hail of Noah's punches. It was almost always necessary for Noah to draw blood before Simon would beg for mercy, and if blood was drawn, somehow Simon had won. The shame was Noah's then. Now Simon appeared committed to pedaling the sewing machine into destruction, both hands gripping the tabletop, his eyes squinted shut against Noah's pounding fists, his knees pumping as furiously as if he were pedaling a bicycle in too low a gear down a steep hill. The savagery with which Noah hit his brother could easily have misled any visitor regarding Noah's truly relaxed disposition and steadily noble character. Noah had learned that striking his brother was a workout requiring patience, deliberation, and strategy. It was no good giving Simon a bloody nose in a hurry. Better to hit him where it hurt, but where he didn't bleed easily. Better to wear him down. But I suspect that Hester must have impressed Owen Meany most of all. In her T-shirt, there was little doubt that she would one day have an impressive bosom.
its early blossoming, was as apparent as her manly biceps, and the way she tore the thread out of her damaged blouse with her teeth, snarling and cursing in the process, as if she were eating her blouse, must have demonstrated to Owen the full potential of Hester's dangerous mouth. At that moment, her basic rapaciousness was quite generously displayed. Naturally, my pleas regarding the inevitable grandmotherly reprimand were not only unheeded, they went as unnoticed as Owen Meany, who stood with his hands clasped behind his back, the sun from the attic skylight shining through his protrusive ears, which were a glowing pink, the sunlight so bright that the tiny veins and blood vessels in his ears appeared to be illuminated from within. The powerful morning sun struck Owen's head from above and from a little behind him, so that the light itself seemed to be presenting him. In exasperation with my unresponsive cousins, I looked up from the sewing machine and saw Owen standing there, with his hands clasped behind his back. He looked as armless as Wadahantuit, and in that blaze of sunlight he looked like a gnome plucked fresh from a fire, with his ears still aflame. I drew in my breath, and Hester, with her raging mouth full of purple thread, looked up at that instant and saw Owen too. She screamed. "I didn't think he was human," she told me later. And from that moment of his introduction to my cousins, I would frequently consider the issue of exactly how human Owen Meany was. There is no doubt that in the dazzling configurations of the sun that poured through the attic skylight, he looked like a descending angel, a tiny but fiery god sent to adjudicate the errors of our ways. When Hester screamed, she frightened Owen so much that he screamed back at her. And when Owen screamed, my cousins were not only introduced to his rare voice, their movements were suddenly arrested. Except for the hairs on the backs of their necks, they froze, as they would if they'd heard a cat being slowly run over by a car. And from deep in a distant part of the great house, my grandmother spoke out, "Merciful heavens, it's that boy again!" I was trying to catch my breath to say, "This is my best friend, the one I told you about," because I had never seen my cousins gape at anyone with such open mouths, and in Hester's case, a mouth from which spilled much purple thread. But Owen was quicker.
"Well, it seems I have interrupted whatever game that was you were playing," Owen said. "My name is Owen Meany, and I'm your cousin's best friend. Perhaps he's told you all about me. I've certainly heard all about you. You must be Noah, the oldest," Owen said.
He held out his hand to Noah, who shook it mutely.
"And of course, you're Simon, the next oldest, but you're just as big and even a little wilder than your brother. Hello, Simon,"
Owen said, holding out his hand to Simon, who was panting and sweating from his furious journey on the sewing machine, but who quickly took Owen's hand and shook it.
"And of course, you're Hester,"
Owen said, his eyes averted.
"I've heard a lot about you, and you're just as pretty as I expected."
"Thank you,"
Hester mumbled, pulling thread out of her mouth, tucking her T-shirt into her blue jeans. My cousins stared at him, and I feared the worst. But I suddenly realized what small towns are. They are places where you grow up with the peculiar. You live next to the strange and the unlikely for so long that everything and everyone become commonplace. My cousins were both small-towners and outsiders. They had not grown up with Owen Meany, who was so strange to them that he inspired awe, yet they were no more likely to fall upon him or to devise ways to torture him than it was likely for a herd of cattle to attack a cat. And in addition to the brightness of the sun that shone upon him, Owen's face was blood red, throbbing, I presumed, from his riding his bike into town, for a late November bike ride down Maiden Hill, given the prevailing wind off the Squamscott, was bitter cold, and even before Thanksgiving, The weather had been cold enough to freeze the freshwater part of the river. There was black ice all the way from Gravesend to Kensington Corners.
"Well, I've been thinking about what we could do,"
Owen announced, and my unruly cousins gave him their complete attention.
"The river is frozen, so the skating is very good, and I know you enjoy very active things like that, that you enjoy things like speed and danger and cold weather. So skating is one idea,"
he said.
"And even though the river is frozen, I'm sure there are cracks somewhere. And even places where there are holes of open water. I fell in one last year. I'm not such a good skater, but I'd be happy to go with you, even though I'm getting over a cold, so I suppose I shouldn't be outside for long periods of time in this weather."
"No," Hester said. "If you're getting over a cold, you should stay inside. We should play indoors. We don't have to go skating. We go skating all the time."
"Yes," Noah agreed. "We should do something indoors, if Owen's got a cold."
"Indoors is best," Simon said. "Owen should get over his cold."
Perhaps my cousins were all relieved to hear that Owen was getting over a cold, because they thought this might partially explain the hypnotic awfulness of Owen's voice. I could have told them that Owen's voice was uninfluenced by his having a cold, and his getting over a cold was news to me. But I was so relieved to see my cousins behaving respectfully that I had no desire to undermine Owen's effect on them.
"Well, I've been thinking that indoors would be best, too," Owen said. "And unfortunately, I really can't invite you to my house, because there's really nothing to do in the house, and because my father runs a granite quarry, he's rather strict about the equipment of the quarries themselves, which are outdoors. Anyway, indoors at my house would not be a lot of fun, because my parents are rather strange about children."
"That's no problem," Noah blurted. "Don't worry," Simon said. "There's lots to do here, in this house."
"Everyone's parents are strange,"
Hester told Owen reassuringly, but I couldn't think of anything to say. In the years I'd known Owen, the issue of how strange his parents were, not only about children, had never been discussed between us. It seemed rather the accepted knowledge of the town not to be mentioned, except in passing, or in parentheses, or as an aside among intimates.
"Well, I've been thinking that we could put on your grandfather's clothes. You've told your cousins about the clothes?"
Owen asked me. But I hadn't. I thought they would think that dressing up in grandfather's clothes was either baby play or morbid or both, or that they would surely destroy the clothes, discovering that merely dressing up in them was insufficiently violent, therefore leading them to a game, the object of which was to rip the clothes off each other. Whoever was naked last won.
"Grandfather's clothes?"
Noah said with unaccustomed reverence. Simon shivered. Hester nervously plucked purple thread from here and there, and Owen Meany, at the moment our leader, said,
"Well, there's also the closet where the clothes are kept. It can be scary in there, in the dark, and we could play some kind of a game where one of us hides and one of us has to find whoever it is in the dark."
"Well," Owen said,
"that could be interesting."
"Yes, hiding in the dark," Simon said.
"I didn't know those were grandfather's clothes in there," Hester said.
"Do you think the clothes are haunted, Hester?"
Noah asked.
"Shut up," Hester said.
"Let Hester hide in there in the dark," Simon said, "and we'll take turns trying to find her."
"I don't want you pawing around in the dark for me," Hester said.
"Hester, we just have to find you before you find us," Noah said.
"No, it's who touches who first," Simon said.
"You touch me, I'll pull your doink, Simon," Hester said.
"Whoa," Noah said.
"That's it. That's the game. We got to find Hester before she pulls our doinks."
"Hester the molester," Simon said, predictably.
"Only if I'm allowed to get used to the dark," Hester said. "I get to have an advantage. I'm allowed to get used to the dark, and whoever's looking for me comes into the closet with no chance to get used to how dark it is."
"There's a flashlight,"
Owen Meany said nervously.
"Maybe we could use a flashlight, because it would still be pretty dark."
"No flashlight," Hester said.
"No,"
Simon said.
Whoever goes into the closet after Hester gets the flashlight shined in his face before he goes in, so he's blind, so he's the opposite of being used to the dark. Good idea, Noah said.
I get as long as I need to get myself hidden, Hester said, and to get used to the dark.
No, Simon said. We'll count to 20.
100, Hester said.
50,
Noah said. So it was 50. Simon started counting, but Hester hit him.
You've got to wait till I'm completely inside the closet, she said.
As she moved toward the closet, she had to brush past Owen Meany, and a curious thing happened to her when she was next to him. Hester stood still and put her hand out to Owen, her big paw, uncharacteristically tentative and gentle, reached out and touched his face, as if there were a force in Owen's immediate vicinity that compelled the passerby to touch him. Hester touched him, and she smiled. Owen's little face was level with those nubbins of Hester's early bosom, which appeared to be implanted under her T-shirt. Owen was quite accustomed to people feeling compelled to touch him, but in Hester's case, he retreated a trifle anxiously from her touch, though not so much that she was offended. Then Hester went clomping into the closet, stumbling over the shoes, and we heard her rustling among the clothes and the hangers squeaking on the metal rods and what sounded like the hat boxes sliding over the overhead shelves. Once she said, "Shit!" and another time, "What's that?" By the time the noises quieted down, we had Simon completely dazed under the flashlight's close-up glare. Simon was eager to be first, and by the time we shoved him into the closet, he was certifiably blind, even if he'd been trying to walk around in the daylight. No sooner was Simon inside the closet, and we'd closed the door behind him, than we heard Hester attack him. She must have grabbed his doink harder than she'd meant to, because he howled with more pain than surprise, and there were tears in his eyes, and he was still doubled over and holding fast to his private parts when he tumbled out of the closet and rolled upon the attic floor.
"Jesus, Hester," Noah said. "What did you do to him?"
"I didn't mean to,"
came her voice from the dark closet.
"No fair pulling the doink and the balls,"
Simon cried, still doubled up on the floor.
"I didn't mean to,"
she repeated sweetly.
"You bitch,"
Simon said.
"You're always rough with me, Simon,"
Hester said.
"You can't be rough with balls and doinks," Noah said.
But Hester was not talking. We could hear her positioning herself for her next attack, and Noah whispered to Owen and me that since there were two doors to the closet, we should surprise Hester by entering from the other door.
"Who is we?"
Owen whispered. Noah pointed to him silently, and I shone the flashlight into Owen's wide and darting eyes, which gave his face the sudden anxiety of a cornered mouse.
"No fair grabbing so hard, Hester," Noah called,
but Hester didn't answer.
"She's just trying to conceal her hiding place,"
Owen whispered, to reassure himself. Then Noah and I flung Owen into the closet through the other door. The closet was L-shaped, and by Owen's entering on the short arm of the L, Noah and I figured that he would not encounter Hester before the first corner, and only then if Hester managed to move, because her hiding place would surely be nearer the top of the L.
"No fair using the other door,"
Hester promptly called, which Noah and I felt was further to Owen's advantage, since she must have given away her position in the closet, at least to some general degree. Then there was silence. I knew what Owen was doing. He was hoping that his eyes would grow used to the dark before Hester found him, and he wasn't going to begin to move to try to find her until he could see a little.
"What in hell's going on in there?"
Simon asked. But there was no sound. Then we detected the occasional bumping of one of Grandfather's hundreds of shoes, then silence, then another slight movement of shoes. As I learned later, Owen was crawling on all fours because he most feared and expected an attack from one of the large overhead shelves. He had no way of knowing that Hester had stretched herself out on the floor of the closet and that she had covered herself with one of Grandfather's topcoats, over which she'd positioned the usual number of shoes. She lay motionless and, except for her head and her hands, invisible. But her head was pointed the wrong way. That is, she had to roll her eyes up into the top of her head and watch Owen Meany approaching her by staring at him upside down, looking over her own forehead and her considerable head of hair. What Owen touched first, as he approached her on all fours, was that live and kinky tangle of Hester's hair, which suddenly moved under his little hand, and Hester's arms reached up over her head, seizing Owen around his waist. To her credit, Hester never had any intention of grabbing Owen's doink. But finding it so easy to hold Owen around the waist, Hester decided to run her hands up his ribs and tickle him. Owen looked extremely susceptible to tickling, which he was, and Hester's gesture was of the friendliest of intentions, especially for Hester, but the combination of putting his hand on live hair in the dark, coupled with being tickled by a girl who, Owen thought, was merely tickling him en route to grabbing his doink, was too much for him. He wet his pants. The instant recognition of Owen's accident surprised Hester so much that she dropped him. He fell on top of her, and he wriggled free of her and out of the closet and through the trapdoor and down the stairs. Owen ran through the house so fast and noiselessly that even my grandmother failed to notice him.